So I have a confession to make. I've actually lied to you and all of our listeners when I said that I haven't seen Ghostbusters 2. It turns out I've actually seen Ghostbusters 2 several times. It's just that I always felt like I'd missed scenes or something like that, but no, that's just how the movie is.
Yeah.
Like, I seem to remember, like, Viggo barely feels like a presence, for one, and I always felt like I'd missed a lot of it, but he's just kind of an ineffective villain. This is, I think in general, Ghostbusters 2 is more of the same, but not as good.
I would agree with that. I was really struck this time because Ghostbusters 2 has never been my favorite movie. I think, obviously, it has a reputation as being unmitigated crap, which I don't think is true. I think that it is both an interesting movie, a funny movie, and a movie that doesn't work all at the same time. And a lot of the there's two main reasons why Ghostbusters 2 doesn't work. The number one reason it doesn't work is that it's a little too cartoony.
Yeah,
the first Ghostbusters was obviously a big, big special effects comedy, but it was grounded in a sense of verisimilitude. It was grounded in a sense of New York as a place. It was helped by being filmed on the streets of New York. And in Ghostbusters 2, all that is true, but a lot of the costuming choices, a lot of the ways that the characters are portrayed, I think a lot of the direction. I mean, I don't know if it was Ivan Reitman kind of giving direction to the actors in the movie, or if they just decided to do that kind of on their own. I don't know.
Well,
but especially like the scene with the trial and the judge is very cartoonish. The entire way that Rick Moranis' character and Gene Mealmitz is in the movie. Gene even looks like a cartoon.
Well, here's the thing. So in between the first movie and this, the cartoon The Real Ghostbusters came out. And so a few elements from the series are in here. For example, Janine's hairstyle and just fashion style, which is very loud and over the top. That was how she was in the cartoon.
And I feel like that was not a good choice for the movie.
No, it was a very good choice for the cartoon. But other things, for example, the presence of Slimer. Slimer was in the cartoon. He was one of the major characters. And Lewis has a couple of moments with him. I don't remember if Lewis was in the cartoon or not, honestly, but he has a few moments with that character that are from nowhere but make sense. In some ways, Ghostbusters was a movie. Ghostbusters 2 is a movie version of the cartoon.
Yeah, and I didn't know that, and I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
why certain elements of this movie don't feel connected at all to the first Ghostbusters movie.
Part of it was the original Ghostbusters was marketed as a comedy maybe for a teenage audience, and of course kids loved the first movie for a lot of obvious reasons, and this movie was made explicitly knowing that there would be a kids' audience, which was not the case with the first.
Well, that's actually really interesting, because a couple of things that I actually really noticed this time are the cursing is much less.
Yeah.
There's this one scene, I think I actually wrote it down, where Venkman, the first time that we see Venkman, he's, performing his television show. And, which is a nice little character, beat for him. But,
and scenes like that, by the way, where it's Bill Murray is doing
we'll talk about
Bill
that.
Murray does, but
he says, "Lie to me and kiss my butt." It's like, why didn't he say ass? Now I know.
Yeah.
There's a beat for beat recreation of the scene in the mayor's office, which is a lot less entertaining because we've seen it before, but also a lot less entertaining because they're not throwing around words like fuck and pecker. so it's just kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah, there are no ghost blowjob scenes in this one.
Yeah, so the entire movie feels a little tamer. I don't think it's necessary.
Which is not to say that the first one was a risque and violent and dark movie.
No, it certainly wasn't, but this one does feel a little more geared towards a children's audience,
yeah.
Manufactured to be child-friendly in a way that the first one was not.
Yes.
I mean, the second reason the movie is kind of less interesting than the first one is, of course, because it's pretty much a beat for beat the same plot as the first
one.
And they even recreate scenes from the first one, which I don't know why they made that choice, frankly. It doesn't work. The mayor's stuff just is like, why is this happening again? The whole scene where, they're in the mental institution instead of the jail. it just, a lot of it is just kind of like, I've seen this before. And maybe they were banking on the fact that this movie came out 5 years later. Of course, we watched Ghostbusters, then we watched Ghostbusters 2 the next week. So it's probable that we noticed things that perhaps the audience in 1989 did not notice. But
still,
it's a problem. It's still lazy, and it still feels like they did this.
It also follows the same exact arc. The first one is rags-to-riches story. It's about a bunch of bumbling slackers who at one point get their shit together, you know, which is the exact same plot here. They start off on the bottom. They have their moment. Instead of the hotel, it's the courtroom scene. They're put back in prominence. We have a montage.
They have a montage again. it's almost like they I know that they had a lot of trouble coming up with a script for this movie, and that's why it took so long for the sequel to come out. It's funny, interestingly enough, there was a interview with, I forget the guy's name, who directed Gremlins. Gremlins and Ghostbusters actually came out the same day.
Zemeckis?
No, that wasn't him.
Did he? No. Joe Dante.
Yes, thank you. Fascinating interview on WTF with Marc Maron. And he really went a lot into sort of like how he got Gremlins and sort of the creation of that and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, that was one of the things he said, where Ghostbusters and Gremlins both came out on the same day in 1984. And both Ghostbusters and Gremlins waited way too long to make sequels. And, you know, I don't think I've ever seen Gremlins 2. He seemed to think it was a lot better than the first one. Maybe it is. But Ghostbusters 2 feels like a little too late. You know, it was 5 years later. An entire generation of kids had like kind of grown up in the meantime, not really, you know, seeing Ghostbusters. And so,
well, it kind of makes the scene with Winston and Ray when they're at the kids' birthday party and the kids think they're totally lame and they just want He-Man instead. I mean, it puts that into a little bit of a different light, doesn't it?
The entire movie feels a little more meta than the first one.
Yeah, which I know is definitely the case with Gremlins 2, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know a little bit about the plot of that movie, even though I've never seen it. Well, and the other thing, too, I mean, it just, like I said, I know that the script for this had been sort of like in development hell for a long time, and they had a lot of trouble coming up with an idea for it. I don't think that Bill Murray wanted to do another one, and they kind of had to talk him into it, if I understand correctly.
And after this was done, he really didn't want anything to do with it, because he felt it was an even more, at least he had some fun on the first one, but yeah, that was one of the things I think that led to the rift between him and Ramis, right?
I think so, yeah. And so, which, you know, luckily I think it was actually Groundhog Day.
Oh.
Yeah, it was Groundhog Day. He did not like making that movie at all. And they made up shortly before Ramis died. But yeah, I think that that's one of the things that strikes me about this movie is that maybe the fact that the matter is that the plot is almost the same and the construction of the movie is almost the same beat for beat, because they really had a hard time coming up with a new and fresh angle on it, and so they basically just remade the first one.
See, what I think is funny is you didn't really play the video game that was released a few years ago.
A little bit, but
in a lot of ways, that's Ghostbusters 3. It is a direct continuation to its dealing with Ivo Shander and Gozer and all of that, but that game is a very much a retread of, you go through the hotel level and the library level and the courtroom, and it is a direct recreation, but it works in that way because, number one, now we're actually playing through them as levels and you could explore a little more. It feels like doing the adaptation, and also it's a good 20 years later. And so it doesn't feel like, again, we watched the two movies right back to back, but in some ways, the time between Ghostbusters 1 and 2 was a long time, about 5 years. And yet in some other ways, it feels like not enough time passed to just make the same movie twice.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, we're going to talk about the Ghostbusters remake that's coming out just in a couple days next week on the season finale of Trek About Presents. I mean, obviously, we have not seen it yet. So I don't know what the structure of that movie is going to be like. I would assume it's going to hew very closely to the original Ghostbusters and therefore to Ghostbusters 2. But I will be disappointed if it does, because what is the point of a third version of this story that is told by, you know, beat by beat? Of course, I should not criticize a movie I've not seen. So,
but well, yeah, we'll see. I know that was number one part of our issue with, and your issue more than mine, with the new Star Wars.
True. Yeah, that was a I had a big problem with that as well. And if you would like to hear our thoughts on The Force Awakens, please go back and listen to our podcast on it that was released last December. Yeah, I you know,
I'm really looking forward to talking about the new movie. Not talking about the movie, but I think a lot of the circumstances around the fact that it's being made and exists are fascinating.
So I think that, I mean,
what's the point of this movie?
I don't know.
Let me ask you, number one, what was the point of Ghostbusters?
It was to make a comedy.
No, but I mean a little.
I don't think there was one. I think it was supposed to be funny, and it works.
Okay.
I don't think there was any larger thematic resonance to, like, America in 1984.
Okay.
This movie does try a little harder to make some sort of thematic resonance between sort of New York at its nadir.
I mean, I got to be honest. At watching the end of the movie, I did find oddly touching, and I think that it partially does come from the news events of the past several days. It's been a very shooty week, hasn't it? And there's been a lot of, you know, there are so many stories of hatred and anger. And to have a movie which ends with very directly the way to counter hatred in and evil is through love and togetherness. And I mean, frankly, dealing with Donald Trump in real life and having a movie which talks about the Statue of Liberty as the best of America was very welcome to see.
Which was given to us by the French, I would like to say. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know that
Is it the deepest message? No, but was it good to see? Sure.
Well, I think it's, I mean, I don't know if that's that interesting to talk about only because it's not that deep.
No.
But I think it's more interesting to talk about it in light of the fact that I think that's the one moment in the movie where they were trying to do something different than the first one.
Yes.
If that makes sense. Because like we've said before, you know, Ghostbusters 2 runs a lot of the same beats, redoes a lot of the same types of scenes. Even the movie ends in pretty much the same fashion.
Yeah.
But that is the one moment where it does feel like Aykroyd and Ramis tried to come up with some sort of thematic resonance that was different than the original Ghostbusters. Like, this feels like them trying to say, okay, why are we making a sequel to Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
And they tried to come up with this sort of connection between where New York was in the late 80s, you know, sort of at its worst. And then, of course, it started to come back a few years later. But, you know, New York was a very rough town in the 80s. And the first movie didn't really deal with that in any real capacity.
Yeah, because really the ending line, oh, I love this town because it's kind of wacky place where this can happen. You
right.
know? But they weren't dealing with
dumped 50 crabs on a train like the other week. So, you know.
No, but the very beginning of this movie when Dana's, you know, pushing and you see all these people yelling at each other or, you know, getting into these little altercations or just, you know, not giving a shit about each other is, I mean, that's what this movie wanted to be about. I don't know. And I think maybe that was lost in the fact that it was remaking itself.
Yeah, I feel like they should have really doubled down on that theme and made the movie about that. You know, I don't know if we really needed to. I mean, I like the beginning of the movie. I like seeing where the characters were 5 years later. I like the revelation that nobody believed what happened. They got sued. You know, they went out of business. They had to go do other things. And so you find out that, you know, Egon is working at some sort of, you know, place. And
let's see what happens when we take away the puppy.
Yeah, he's working at some, he's a professor again. He's working at some institute for medical studies or some very generic name like that.
Yeah.
So he's obviously not working at Columbia. I mean, they were at Columbia in the first movie, which is a, you know, very prestigious Ivy League university.
Yeah.
So he's gone downhill a little bit. You've got Venkman, you know, hosting this awful, looks like some sort of
public access local label.
Cable show. That's even now. It wasn't good. Public access isn't even that fancy. But, you know, like it's some sort of like local cable show or something like that. The kind of thing that they would show on, you know, Saturday afternoons on Channel 7.
Yeah, something that takes $10 to make.
Channel 11 or something like that.
Getting the styrofoam for the set was the glitter was the most expensive thing.
And then you've got, you know, Spengler, who's working at his own bookshop or stance.
Right.
I can never remember.
Yeah. And he and Winston are doing birthday parties to get a little extra cash because obviously that bookstore is not making much money.
Yeah. Well, you know, It was on St. Mark's in 1989. Everyone was scared to go there. Well, yeah, and I think that, you know, there is some subtlety to the movie. I mean, the movie is very cartoony, and a lot of it is not subtle at all. But, you know, for example, when they're driving to the children's birthday party and the Ecto-1 is sort of belching smoke, you know, that's kind of a subtle indication that things are not going well for them. Mm-hmm. The movie kind of slyly hints at the fact that they are not actually Ghostbusters anymore. And then, of course, they get to the birthday party, and, of course, it's revealed that they're not Ghostbusters anymore. So that kind of stuff works. I just, you know, my question is, do you think that we needed to see? I mean, on the one hand, that's the part of the movie that I think works the best. On the other hand, they quickly jettison that entire plot line and go back to remaking Ghostbusters to get them back at a point where they were before. So I don't know. What was the point of that? Like, I kind of feel like I wish they had stuck with that throughout the movie.
Yeah, and maybe they're just doing, you know, maybe it's more interesting if they're just trying to solve this one case and figure out what's happening to Dana if they don't even know if it's a actual psychic manifestation. The stronger bits of the movie are when they're trying to figure out a way to ghost bust without actually having the license to do so. I mean, my favorite scene is when they're digging up the street and they're trying, you know, pretending to be Con Ed workers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. It's a fantastic scene and it really works. I mean, obviously, you know, we have to talk about Bill Murray in this movie. He's doing a great job again and he's really grounding the movie.
I think in general,
I mean, he's obviously a little tired, but
well, we said about the first movie, you know, this is a movie where, you know, it's good material and all of the performances elevated into great material. Well, in this, they elevated into good material.
Yeah.
I think as a way of getting, because again, Sigourney Weaver is even better in this than I'd say in the first movie. You know,
yeah.
Everybody is great in this.
I don't know that Rick Moranis is that great in this movie. And partially because they completely changed his character from the first movie.
Yes.
Which, you know, you mentioned earlier, you don't know if he was in the cartoon. I kind of feel like he must have been.
I vaguely remember. I don't know if this is a phantom memory, and I guess it could be easier for us to look it up, but why would we do that?
Yeah, we're not going to do that.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe in some ways, it feels like they...
Well, because
they tried to have it both ways. They tried to make a sequel to the first movie and they tried to adapt the cartoon, and it does neither very well.
Yeah, because like Louis Tully in the first movie, you know, he's a little bit of a loser, but he also has, you know, he's a lot more with it than he is in this movie. He's an accountant. And then suddenly they jettison all that in this movie. He is some sort of weird lawyer, doesn't really know much.
Well, he's their accountant now. You know,
no, he's their lawyer.
No, he's dealing with their accounts and their law, but he's certainly dealing with their more contract law type stuff.
Yeah, but he said he went to law school and night school between the time of Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2. It's like and the performance of Louis Tully, the way he's written and the sort of like weird awkwardness of the character. Like, yes, that was there in the first movie, but it's really amped up to 10. Mm. And it doesn't work. Like, what happened to that character between Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2 to make him this, like, nebbishy and losery?
Well, he went to night school.
Right. There's no answer for that. It's just like we're not supposed to notice.
I don't think we're supposed to even care, yeah, because let's pretend he was indeed in the cartoon. That's who he was in the cartoon.
But it makes the movie worse.
Yes.
Like, that's the problem with it, is like making this a version of the cartoon makes it a worse movie.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember if there was, because I know the cartoon is called The Real Ghostbusters, and I think there is an intention that, you know, pretending that the first movie was a movie version of their lives and, you know, the cartoon is what their actual day-to-day, you know what I mean, kind of thing, but I don't know.
It doesn't work.
But I think it's generally agreed that it doesn't work.
Well,
But
that's the thing, though, is like everyone is like, oh, this movie is unmitigated crap.
No.
It's really not, though. I mean, there's enough here of the old flashes of Ghostbusters that
it's
works.
I will say it's not a cynical movie.
No.
It's not like people are doing it are doing this because they really had a good time doing it the first time and they want to, you know, reprise that. And, you know, it's not just done to capture, you know, Ivan Reitman and, you know, Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver were not just trying to make a buck on this movie. You know, they were actually invested in it. But, I mean, and maybe there is a tension.
Where are you getting that from?
I don't know. I'm just making it up.
I don't think they were.
All right, no one was invested in this.
They got a nice paycheck, but, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I would imagine that Columbia Pictures really pressured them to make a sequel because the first one made a lot of money. Yeah, and they probably didn't really want to do it, which is probably why it took them so long to make it. I mean, you know, it's not like this is a necessary movie to make. And I don't know that. I mean, they obviously had to talk Bill Murray into doing that. But that probably took 4 years. You know, I mean, like, there are things about it where you look at it and you say, okay, I don't think that anyone was really into making this movie. I think that they wrote a script that is half parts wanting to do something new, half parts adopting the cartoon for some bizarre reason, probably because that was what was more in people's current memory of Ghostbusters than the first Ghostbusters, and partly a remake of Ghostbusters. And some of that probably had to do with time. Some of that probably had to do with where they were. And some of that probably had to do with the fact that they didn't care that much.
And maybe if they had been able to be more decisive, we would have gotten a better movie and we have got more of an investment. I don't know.
An investment? How do you
mean? Like, people would have been more invested in the process if they had had a stronger focus to it.
Yeah, but then again, I mean, they did get everybody to come back. Yeah. So it's one of those questions where you look at it and you say, okay, Sigourney Weaver, she's great in this movie. I mean, Sigourney Weaver is a fantastic actor anyway.
Yeah.
But she really does a great job in this movie. And Bill Murray is doing a good job in this
movie. But you don't get the sense, number one, that he was, I don't know, he feels like he's hewing a little closer to script in this movie somehow.
I would agree with that.
That's partially just comparing the performances in the two things. He very much is playing the same character, but it's a more mannered and measured version of it.
I don't know that I can really verbalize this, but I can tell when Bill Murray is improvising, and
I can tell
Bill Murray is sticking to the script. And there's sort of a liveliness to it, a sort of a real raw feeling to when he's improvising that is not there when he's just sticking to the script.
Yeah.
And you're right, there's a lot less of that sort of verisimilitude raw feeling to his performance.
Yeah.
And you know, it's certainly there. I mean, I think that the Con Ed scene is a perfect example of that.
Yes.
There are some other moments where it's
that scene was very
coming up with things, but you know,
and I think the reason I like that scene is because you can tell it's very much there was a very loose outline and the three of them are just, you know, enjoying working with each other at that moment.
Yeah, and I wish that there was more of that. I mean, obviously it's difficult to do. I think that this movie, I feel like this movie had more special effects than the first one too. I mean, you've got the whole River of Slime, got, you know, the whole Vigo sections, you know, the end of the movie has a lot more stuff going on with Vigo walking around and taking the baby and, you know, stuff like that. So
if the Statue of Liberty thing.
The Statue of Liberty thing, which is, you know, pretty impressive. I mean, it's kind of obvious that it's a woman dressed up as a Statue of Liberty in some scenes, but it works fine.
I mean, it's similar enough to the Marshmallow Man segments of the first movie, and yet, you know, compare the shots of the two movies. Obviously, the Statue of Liberty is a much more elaborate sequence.
Yeah, yeah. And also they that's the thing, is like when they, I guess that's a perfect example of where the movie falls down for me, is that the Statue of Liberty and the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man are obviously versions of the same thing, but they are very, very different, sort of almost inverse thematic moments. And, you know, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is their greatest defeat. It's frightening as hell. And the Statue of Liberty is their greatest triumph. This is their idea. They're trying to get everybody on the streets of New York to give them positive energy to help them.
I will say that, you know, part of the reason Ray chooses the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, he says, is because it's, you know, such a symbol of warmth and love. It reminds me of him of childhood campfires, but it's perverted into something evil. And the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of hope and welcome and unity and love. And it remains all of those things.
Right. It remains all of those things. Whereas they're doing the same kind of scene, but they're doing it for a very different reason, a very different thematic resonance. Whereas, you know, the mayor scene, the courtroom scene, the montage, it just feels like they're retreading the scene.
Yes.
And they don't do anything interesting or new with them, and they're just doing the same scenes over again.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. I mean, I'm fine to have the mayor of New York in this movie again, but they needed to do something different with that scene. They needed to do something different with, I mean, they even go so far as to have the same kind of guy,
yeah,
as Peck in the first movie. Only the actor playing him is fine, but he's not given the best material to work with. I don't get a good sense of who he is as a character. And, you know,
I mean, I have to say that, you know, after the first movie, William Atherton was apparently harassed by a lot of people who, you know, yelled at him, you know, fuck you, Walter Peck. This guy is not getting that, you know, thrown at him.
Oh, I don't know how the movie did, like, financially.
I don't know.
I'll have to look that up afterwards.
And I mean, talking about special effects, we did say the first blended the special effects, the comedy, the scary bits all very well. Partially because they did in some ways have to be restrained or work around.
Yeah.
And maybe because of the – maybe this is a case where a bigger budget meant they didn't have to – you know, they were putting a lot more work on the effects than they were on the performances. Maybe, for example, they didn't have as much time to shoot multiple takes of a scene and have Bill Murray just, you know, fuck around, you know.
Right.
I obviously I don't know what the action process of the first movie was, but you'd assume – you know, it's common enough with actors like that to, all right, do one take, you know, following the script and then do whatever.
I don't know about that. I don't think that movie budgets generally work like that. I mean, they get a certain amount of time to shoot the movie and that's what they get. I mean, I don't think that the call comes from a different line item. So, and also the movie had a slightly larger budget than the first Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
It's not a huge, I mean, the first Ghostbusters had a $30 million budget and this one had a $37 million budget.
Okay.
And this was also 5 years later. So, you know, I mean, you could probably say roughly comparable.
Then maybe just simple lack of exuberance. I mean, yeah, as you said, maybe everyone's just kind of tired.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case.
Would you want to necessarily do a thing you did 5 years ago? I mean, again, you can especially picture someone like Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver wanting to have moved on.
Yeah, I mean, then again, Sigourney Weaver did do three alien movies. So,
well, I mean, talk about, I know for the fourth one, she famously has a quote where she said, you know, I didn't want to do the fourth movie, but I'm not made of stone. They drove a truck full of money to my house and I had to do it.
Yeah. She got that second pool.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, the other thing too about the movie is that the timeline of it makes absolutely no sense.
Oh, yeah. Like it's less than a month.
Yeah. It starts out in, I think, late October or early November.
There's Christmas decorations from the very first scene. So we would –
there's a calendar at one point that is very obviously put in the shot to give it a sense of time, and it's put on November. So
okay.
We could say it's early November.
Well, I mean, given the decorations, I'd say it's right post-Thanksgiving, but especially in 89. I mean, nowadays you have Christmas decorations in October.
Well, whether it's one month or 2 months, it doesn't matter that much.
It ends at New Year's Eve and it begins when there's Christmas decorations around. So that's a general idea.
I mean, they would have been waiting for a year for a trial.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason why. I mean, the whole thing is just kind of like, what? And I guess you wouldn't necessarily notice this if you were just watching the movie for fun, but watching it critically, it really...
Well, we did say that about the first movie. We weren't sure exactly how much time in between was spent.
But that's okay, though. I don't think that
the first one doesn't really have a... This one ends with a deadline of New Year's Eve, so the movie itself is bringing time frame into consideration.
There's not enough time for all of this to happen.
Yeah.
And I think obviously there's not enough time for them to go to trial, right? I mean, that just would not happen. That would take a year for them to go to trial.
It's a movie.
No,
okay.
I can't get over that. That's just dumb. That's just lazy. There's no reason for that. Like... I think it's just a way for them to come up with a scene that works, like the hotel scene.
Yeah.
But again, why put obstacles in their way if you're not going to come up with a logical timeline for it to work with? That's my problem with it. It's like, it's not that big a deal if that was the only problem with the movie, but
if you want to talk about problems with the trial scene, how about the fact that Winston is seen at the trial, but he doesn't actually fight the Scolari brothers?
Yeah, well, I think there were only three proton packs there. So
he's just going to fuck off and not, like, help?
Yeah, he's a hired hand. What does he care?
They give Winston some things to do in this movie.
A lot more than the first one, for sure.
But they still, and in the beginning particularly, and that scene felt egregious to me, they don't 100% figure out what to do with him as a character.
No, they don't. And I think that, I will say that I think that having Winston not fight in that scene has a lot more to do with them wanting to recreate the hotel.
Yeah, than that's fair.
Else, which, you know, is that a good reason? I don't know. I mean, I don't really. We're having a problem with the fact that the movie recreates scenes beat for beat. So it would have been a nice thing to have Winston fight with them.
Yeah. And again, because I feel like that scene, number one, whatever you will say about Winston, I don't think he's the kind of person who, when his three people he's working with are in danger, is just going to fuck off and leave the room, you know, even if whether he has equipment or not.
Well, because the thing is, too, I mean, let's look at it this way. You know, Winston 5 years ago may have done that.
Yes.
But what I like about
this is a Winston who has fought Gozer.
Fought Gozer, but also I think more importantly has a very seems to have a pretty strong friendship with Ray.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, the first movie they were really the only two Ghostbusters. I mean, Ray was the only Ghostbusters in the first movie that I think had any screen time with Winston by himself
when they're in the car. Yeah,
yeah. So they kind of established that friendship developing in that movie, and I like that. That's where they went in this movie, where Ray and Winston are still trying to make some extra cash by doing the birthday parties, and they seem to have a better friendship.
And they also seem to be, number one, Winston and Ray are the only two who also seem to be keeping with the Ghostbusters, because both Venkman and Egon have careers that have nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you can call what Venkman is doing a career.
Well, you know, I mean, it's basically what we do.
I guess. Yeah. No, I don't do this for money.
Well, yeah, we do.
Or I do. We go to patreon.com/trekaboutshow. All right. Let's talk about the elephant in the room.
Which one?
Let's talk about Janosch. What is this?
I know. I mean, like,
just what is this?
This is going a lot.
Is he supposed to be funny because he has a weird accent?
I don't know. He's from the Upper West Side. When Peter says, "Where are you from?" and I feel like that was maybe was an improvised line. But,
yeah, I think so.
I don't know. One of the things we said with the first movie is that Dana gets into all these situations with Lewis, with Venkman, with, you know, where she, like, dudes are hitting on her a lot more than she wants to. And she's
You know what? That's a thing that happens.
No, I know.
I don't see it, number one, because other men don't do that around other men. So that's a thing, apparently. Mm. The other thing, too, is I may not notice because I'm gay. But yeah, I buy it. Women get hit on a lot, unbidden. They don't want it. That happens. That's a real thing that happens. So
I know. Yeah, I that's know. Not. I guess what I it wasn't saying. Like I found that unrealistic. Or
oh
something.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I found it unfortunate that that's where the main villain is in this movie too. That, you know, this is just Dana doesn't get a fucking break in that regard. But and even worse, this is her boss. Like, I don't know. It's a move that it's a move that you can tell was more innocuous in 89 than it reads in 2016.
Yeah, he's pretty aggressively creepy.
Mm.
And I mean, that scene where he goes to her apartment in the blackout, it's like, why would she even open the door? Like, that's just
No, I know. And granted, at that point, he's possessed, you know, but I think they were I think their intention was made to, he's obviously in love, but he's someone that they're, you know, she's not going to take seriously, and she isn't, you know, threatened as, and he becomes threatening. But
yeah. I mean, that is a consistent character beat for her in both movies, of course, is that she's used to this attention. She knows how to fob it off without getting them upset.
Yeah.
And she's not necessarily afraid.
No.
But it is still
at the same time. At the same time, she is a woman who has a baby and took this job temporarily because let's say it was part time, you know, and she, you know, she could get easier, whatever.
I'm just nitpicking at this point, but
yeah.
You don't just get a job
restoring art,
restoring like antique paintings.
No,
like, you need to go to school for that. So the fact of the matter is, like, she leaves the orchestra for reasons that are ill defined.
I mean, I'm. In both cases, both playing cello in a symphony orchestra and art restoration, it's true, are careers that you need to spend all time training for.
You don't just show up at the Manhattan Museum of Art. And that's
like, you could see her doing.
That's another thing too that bothers me, is like the first movie was really grounded in a sense of New York as a real place. Like, they're at Columbia, you know. They're not at the Met. They're at the Manhattan Museum of Art. It's like, all right, anyway.
You could see her if she was working in the offices at the museum, or, you know, she was doing some maybe very basic help for this, and he was, you know, or she's being a tour guide or something like that. Where, you know, sure, there are plenty of jobs at a museum that somebody who, you know, works in the arts and may know people in the arts would be able to do that doesn't require such specialized. I mean, the movie doesn't really know what art restoration is, I guess.
I guess that's true, yeah. But, I mean, it should.
Yes. You could still have the same plot with her just being, you know, again, working in the offices. You know, you have this painting. It doesn't need to be being restored.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then I guess, well, the other thing to talk about is you know, is Dana's relationship with Venkman and also the baby. I mean, the baby's fine. I think generally speaking, putting a baby into a movie like this is a huge problem. But I don't have a problem with it in this movie.
Well, part of it is because when Venkman is playing with the baby, that's some more of, you know, Bill Murray showing through.
Yeah,
and
that works.
So,
well.
You know, those are the nice. And I will say, you know, the two of them and the baby do have a very, like, there's the scene where they're just hanging out on the bed and chatting. And, like, it is very natural between the, their chemistry is very good. And those are nice scenes.
I don't think that Venkman could afford that apartment even in 1989.
Oh, no.
I think that was on the corner of, like, Bleecker and something. I don't know. In Soho or something. Well, yeah, and that was a big apartment.
Maybe he came from money.
I'm just picking nits now because I'm like, I know New York. That was not going to be a thing anyway.
Yeah. Well, how could they have afforded the firehouse in the first place is my question.
Well, it was in a shitty part of town
in
1984 that no one went to. So
that's fair.
That kind of makes sense to me, I guess. Yeah, I think that, I mean, I don't know how I feel about the movie creating this whole backstory about them having a relationship and then her sort of, I guess we're supposed to assume that she married the guy with the nasal spray from the first movie and had a baby and then he abandoned them.
Well, it didn't work out and he got a career and they kind of, yeah.
You don't just leave to go to London when you have a baby, though. I mean, that's a pretty shitty thing to do.
Well, it's not implied that he's the best guy. The movie doesn't necessarily spend time on them. And while it seems that Dana isn't exactly hurting financially or, you know, in any way from from raising a kid alone.
Yeah, she's got a fucking huge apartment.
Yeah, you know, but she certainly doesn't really seem to think about this guy anymore. It wasn't necessarily the best relationship. Maybe it was someone she had a fling with, got pregnant, and then, you know, decided to make a go of it after Venkman left.
Yeah, I guess that could be true.
That's, I guess, the implication, and she's not exactly doing poorly without him. So, you know, things are fine. She has her baby. She has her life.
Yeah, and I think the other reason why the baby works in this movie is because it puts Dana in a similar emotional place than she was in the first movie, but it's doing a different thing because it's not putting her specifically, her person in danger. It's putting her baby in danger. So yes, on the one hand, it is a little bit of the woman is having a, you know, a problem with her baby. Okay. But it does do a little bit of a different thing, which I appreciate. And I think that what I'm finding talking about Ghostbusters 2 is that it's not a terrible movie.
No.
There are things about it which are interesting or entertaining or thematically, resonant. But when it's doing a different thing, it's pretty good. When it's retreading the original Ghostbusters and not doing anything new or interesting with it, it's not very interesting. And, you know, at the end of the day, I guess what we're left with is a movie that is not necessary and didn't really need to be made.
But could have been.
What does that mean?
I mean...
Oh, you mean like they could have made a good Ghostbusters
Yes.
too?
Again, you know, going with the bits when you see a real movie poking through where it doesn't have to follow these certain beats, it's really good. It's interesting. It's funny.
I would agree with you if this movie had come out 2 years after the first Ghostbusters.
And yes, that is part of the issue too.
Since it came out 5 years later and they had a lot of time...
Yeah,
I think this is the best one they could have come up with.
Yeah,
I don't think they wanted to do it. I think that they got thrown a bunch of money. Yeah, it's a bit stale. I think they got thrown a bunch of money to do it, and this is the best thing they could come up with.
Well,
you know, if they really had a great idea for a second movie, I don't think it would have been this, obviously.
Yeah.
And I also don't think it would have taken 5 years for it to come out.
Hmm. Yeah, and I mean, like, I guess, I don't know. To me, I'm, again, armchair quarterbacking, but it doesn't seem that hard to give, you know, to make a movie, number one, where they are still, you know, ghost busting and then they get a really big case and something happens, you know, again, they could be regular ghostbusting and then suddenly Viggo appears. They could do that same plot. I don't know. It doesn't seem like an impossible thing to do.
Yeah, maybe they thought that it wouldn't have been that interesting. I don't know. I mean, maybe they feel like it was so long since the first movie that they needed to sort of reintroduce everything and have it be like a second plot pilot in effect.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just spitballing here, but I'm trying to come up with a reason for why they did that and, you know, kind of failing.
I guess part of the thing, you know, and maybe if then there was a Ghostbusters 3 2 years later and a Ghostbusters 4 and like then this became I know that sounds horrible, but at the same time you could justify them making a second pilot in a way if they wanted to make it into a bigger franchise. But at this point, nobody, you know, that was the end.
It became
the cartoon. That became Ghostbusters.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I mean, Ghostbusters 2 didn't make as much money as the first one, but it still did really well. I mean, The first one made about $300 million, and the second one made a little over $200 million, so it's not like it flopped.
It still made back its budget a few times.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I think it's, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, we'll probably talk about this more when we talk about the reboot next week, but the fact that Ghostbusters 3 apparently didn't really become a thing until 10 or 15 years after this movie, and then it was sort of in development hell.
Yeah.
And, you know, Aykroyd tried to talk Bill Murray into doing it for a long time, and Bill Murray didn't want to do it, and, you know, and then Ramis dying, like, indicates to me that Ghostbusters has always been a thing that they'd never really want to do, and I think that Aykroyd probably wanted to do a Ghostbusters 3, frankly, because what has he been doing the past 20 years? I mean, I'm not trying to be rude, but
no.
Aykroyd has sort of disappeared. So I kind of feel like that was probably his attempt to get back into some sort of movie.
No, I mean, definitely Dan Aykroyd passed his prime at some point, which is a shame. You know, Bill Murray never kind of really did.
Well, Bill Murray,
Bill Murray stayed gold.
Aykroyd is, let's be honest. Yeah. Aykroyd is not the best actor, and he doesn't do a great job in this movie. I mean, he's
good at playing Ray, but that's about what he can do.
His line readings are a little too stilted. I don't get a good sense of him. He's not a very good emoter.
Yeah.
Bill Murray is a much better actor than him.
You know, to a degree, he's playing a scientist whose head is in paranormal stuff all the time. He can get away with playing this character a little stilted.
Sure.
But you know, after a while, he's going to play the same exact character every time, and it's not that fascinating.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, I think that is...
This movie would not have launched Ghostbusters if this had been the first one.
No, I don't think so.
It would have been just a weird movie that, you know, people saw on cable at some point.
Well, that's Ghostbusters 2. If you have any thoughts that you would like to share with us, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at trekaboutshow.com. If you have been enjoying our podcasting endeavors for a week, a month, a year, maybe since we started back in 2012, and you want to give us a little bit of support, you can do so at patreon.com/trekaboutshow. We do a patron special every month for people that give us $5 a month or more. And the one that we just released a couple weeks ago was the discussion of Spock, Data, and Odo.
Ooh.
The three characters that kind of look at humans.
It's a great one.
It is. It's good. They're all good.
It's the best podcast we have ever recorded.
I wouldn't go that far. The best podcast that we have ever recorded
is the one we're going to record next week.
There you go. We're on social media. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Trek About Show. And as always, please leave us a positive iTunes review for Trek About Presents and Trek About. Why not? Next week, we are wrapping up this season of Trek About Presents. We are going to be talking about the reboot Ghostbusters. I was waiting for Richard to go. There you go.
I'm sorry. I was just thinking about the fact that we have to go to an actual movie theater.
You're fine. Richard has agoraphobia.
It's a dark room and there's loud noises and people I don't know and popcorn, for Christ's sake.
I'm only kind of kidding. That's why he and my dog get along so well.
The dog and I just don't have to talk or think about anything. We just kind of be.
My dog's name is Hank, and one of the babies in the movie was named Hank.
Aw.
So there's a connection for you there.
Wait, there was only one baby in the movie.
But they were played by twins. We'll see you next week for Ghostbusters.